this is Allison Sheridan of the NoCellaCast podcast, hosted at podfeet.com, technology geek podcast with an ever-so-slight Apple bias. Today is Saturday, April 22nd, 2017, and this is show number 624. I'm pushing out the show a day early today because Steve and I are heading off to Las Vegas again to go to NAB, the National Association of Broadcasters. This is not the perfect show for us because it's more for high-end folks like, you know, NBC and CNN. They've got these giant wall monitor things, TVs that are like the size of a football field, and they got cameras that are $40,000 a day to rent, but it's still really fun. We usually manage to get a couple of interviews in that you'll enjoy. We also get to hang out with Don McAllister and Chuck Joyner, so that's going to be fun too. Usually Dave Hamilton's there, but he's not going to make it this year, so that's kind of a bummer. The show is going to be a bit short this week because of that compressed schedule. I should also mention that means that there is no live show on Sunday, tomorrow, April 23rd. I know I've said this before, but it's really lonely recording without you guys there. It's really kind of weird. I really should make Steve watch me on YouTube Live when I record by myself so I have an audience. Well, on Chit Chat Across the Pond this week, we've got a great guest. With the recent legislation on privacy rules for ISPs in the United States, a lot of people are considering using VPNs to protect their internet traffic from home. I thought this would be a great time to get Dave Peck on the show, co-founder of Cloak, the VPN service I use. This isn't a show about Cloak, but rather about VPNs in general. We talked about whether we should consider one for our home use. We talk about what kind of information your VPN provider may be collecting on you. We talk about the importance of understanding privacy policies as well and what those mean to you. Dave is very frank and honest about things like how Cloak handles things like logging of user data and what they do with that data. Dave has also answered some listener questions during the show. There's some real surprises in this episode, in particular what you should know about those top five VPN lists you may have seen cropping up recently. I thought I knew where this discussion was going to go, and I was very surprised. Remember last week when I talked about how there was a weird bug affecting some of the pages, like the Podfeet Press page, where some people on some browsers would get these giant black bars on the page, followed by a big black circle with an X in it, and then a giant black arrow? Well, I wrote up last week how proud I was of myself when I figured out that it had to do with insecure elements on a secure page. I patted myself on the back quite publicly about it. Well, imagine my dismay this week when Seth Rosenblum showed me that he was still seeing this problem, but on a different page. This time it was on the NoCellaCast podcast page. I installed Firefox. I hadn't put it on my new machine yet. And sure enough, I saw the dreaded awful symbols he was seeing. I didn't understand. How could I possibly eliminate something that I couldn't see in Safari, but I could see in Firefox? Why would these two browsers render it completely differently? One correctly and one really weird. I mentioned this to Bart and he said, sounds like some of the CSS maybe wasn't loading. And if he were me, he would take a look at the network tab in the web console. We didn't have much time to chat, so the next day I did that just that by myself. I opened the NoCellaCast page in one Firefox window where it showed the big errors, and then the Chit Chat Across the Pond light page in a second Firefox window because that one was rendering correctly. I ran the network tab on both of those, and as Bart suspected, there was a problem with CSS loading. By the way, CSS is cascading style sheets, and that's what formats the page to make it look pretty for you. But the problem was none of the CSS was loading on that page at all. Here's the annoying part. I don't create those pages. In WordPress, I write blog posts. If the post is a NoCellaCast episode, I add the category NoCellaCast to it. If it's a Chit Chat Across the Pond light, I add that category. Then in WordPress, I can call up all of the posts within a single category by entering something like podfeet.com/blog/category/NoCellaCast. And then WordPress auto-generates that page. So how could the auto-generation of the Chit Chat Across the Pond light category page load the CSS correctly and the one for NoCellaCast not load it correctly? I was baffled. I began to write on Telegram to Bart, even though I knew he was away on one of his bike rides. I kept writing sort of as a way to try to document what I was figuring out, maybe a little bit as therapy. I then Googled my little fingers to the bone trying to figure this out. What the heck do you Google? Big ugly black bars followed by a circle with an X in it and a big arrow? Well, it turns out that doesn't find anything, even if you add WordPress to the search. Well, of course, it finds something, but not what you're looking for. I kept mutating this question. I added Site Origin to it. That was the name of my theme vendor, but I had no luck. Finally, it occurred to me to start searching for what could cause CSS not to load on one page. After going down a lot of blind alleys, I decided to ask Site Origin for help. I got my theme for free, but they have a premium option to get email support instead of just access to the discussion forum. The premium support was only $29 a year, and I figured we had all collectively gotten easily $29 worth of fun out of this new theme, so I ponied up the $29. I wrote them a polite email asking them whether there's any chance the theme was causing the problem. I certainly didn't accuse them because I'm still baffled what was going on. I didn't know what it was. And let's see, after I sent the email, I found out that unfortunately they're based in South Africa, which is pretty much in the exact opposite time zone from me. So I was going to have to wait till the next day for a response. I figured we could survive that long. Well, I kept noodling the problem, and finally, I was able to find a link to a discussion forum on the site origin webpage of all places, talking about what can cause CSS not to load. There was a link to a whole list of causes, and the first thing they said was sometimes caching plugins can cause problems on the server side that can cause this behavior. Well, I had installed a plugin ages ago called WP Cache on my site. I don't remember exactly how it was supposed to work, or I remember it being something about server-side caching, but in theory, it was supposed to speed up page loading. The good news is that as soon as I deactivated WP Cache, the giant black bars, circles, X's, and arrows of doom were finally gone. I was so happy I'd figured this out, mostly on my own, with certainly a big tip from Bart. By the way, I wrote back to the site origin people and said, never mind, I found the problem, and they wrote back right away. So one of the guys answered in the middle of the night. Not sure why they did that, but I was happy. So I fixed this problem early this week. But while I was writing this up for the show, I got an email from John Rogers showing me that he was still seeing the error. He couldn't believe it. Then I had an idea. I asked him if he'd clear his browser cache, and sure enough, that fixed the problem for him. So if you see the big black bars, the circle with the arrow in it, or circle with the X in it and the big arrow, please first try clearing your browser cache. If that doesn't fix it, definitely let me know. After we resolved the problem, John mentioned the only thing he didn't like about the new design was that the Podfeet logo was a little bit big on his phone screen. I remembered when I built the beta site, there was a little switch I could turn on that automatically shrinks the logo when you scroll. As a reward for John and everyone else, I flipped that switch. Not a dramatic change. It doesn't like shrink down to a teeny little thing, but it is a little bit smaller. The good news is I think I killed that bug, and the work I did last week to get rid of some of the insecure elements was not a wasted effort. Many thanks to everyone who wrote in telling me about this problem. This week, I've been working on a video for Don McAllister's Screencast Online all about the Finder. I know that sounds like something everybody knows about, but I did a really deep dive into all of the Finder preferences and view options and sidebar and toolbar modifications I know how to make. It's a pretty fun video, if I do say so myself. When I started working on it, I told Steve this one was going to be an easy video because at least I wasn't dealing with a third-party vendor where the software might have bugs in it. That always slows me down. So guess what I found? Two bugs in macOS. Here's the first one. In Finder Preferences on the Advanced tab, there's a checkbox to show all file name extensions. If you check that box, you see, you know, .pdf, .jpeg, .doc, and all the other extensions on every file in every window. If you uncheck the box, the extensions are supposed to go away. But it turns out the behavior is not consistent. I can check and uncheck that box over and over without changing anything else, and sometimes it works, and sometimes it doesn't. I made a video demonstrating this failure, and I put a link in the show notes if you're interested in seeing it for yourself. By the way, there is a way you're supposed to be able to always hide extensions. If you click on a file and do a git info, there's a little checkbox where you can say, hide this extension. The Finder preference is supposed to override that switch, but sometimes it does and sometimes it doesn't. This was really frustrating because I wasn't certain it was a bug, or was it possible it was something I was doing wrong? So it was really frustrating and I couldn't move forward with doing the video. I called Apple and I got my new little friend Amy, a senior advisor, on the phone. She was awesome. I explained the failure I'd found and she was able to replicate it pretty quickly. She did a search and determined that I was the first person to report this bug. I was kind of proud of that one. I figured since I had her on the phone, I'd try getting credit for another bug find. I demonstrated the second bug, which was in the View Options menu. And while she watched my screen, she saw it, but she was unable to replicate it on her computer. She was struggling with how to get it to happen and find the pattern I was talking about. So I suggested we both set up the exact same set of folders on our desktops so I could walk her through the problem in a controlled environment where she could do the same thing I was doing. I told her to create a folder on her desktop, and I asked her to name it Boogers, as one does. She laughed and said she couldn't wait to get home to tell her 11-year-old daughter that someone had made her call a folder Boogers. I knew then Amy and I were going to be friends. Inside Boogers, I asked her to create another folder called Snot. Then I asked her what, I told her we needed another folder parallel to Snot, and I asked her, what should we call that? She said immediately, my daughter would, of course, call it Slime. So to review, we've got Boogers with Snot and Slime inside it. Now for the bug. If you click on Boogers, and in the Finder menu you choose View, Show View Options, you're going to get a pop-up menu to control things like font size, icon size, and more. At the top of that pop-up menu, it should say the name of the folder, so it should say Boogers. Well, it turns out that the bug is that it shows the name of the folder you were in right before the folder you just selected. Let me walk you through that. If you click on Boogers, and then next you click on Snot, the menu will say Boogers at the top when it should say Snot. Switch to the parallel folder Slime, and now it'll say Snot. So it isn't the one above, and it's just the last one you were in before you got to that. So once you're on Slime, go up a level to Boogers, and now it's going to say Slime. You following the pattern here? Well, the good news is she confirmed that this indeed is another bug and isn't working at all like it's supposed to work. She searched, and again, she told me I had found a bug that no one else had reported. Amy said she needed to write this up for engineering and that they'd get back to me on it in a few days. I know they won't, but the senior advisors always think engineering really does get back to you. Anyway, I begged her in her write-up to use Boogers and Snot and Slime in the description. She said, of course I'm going to do that. They got to have fun too. I love Amy. Anyway, I was pretty happy to have discovered this and really enjoyed talking to Amy, so it was a very good day. The only problem was I had to plaster all over the video for Don. This is a bug. I've reported this bug to Apple. But at least I was kind of proud of myself. People love clocks. I'm not sure why, but even in the middle of the night, if we wake up, we want to know what time it is. Not sure why. But a clock on your bedside table can be problematic if the numbers are too bright and keep you awake. A lot of people keep their phones plugged in next to their beds, but it's kind of a hassle to wake them up. If you've got a phone, a tablet, a smartwatch, and a clock, where do you plug in your bedside lamp if you've got all that stuff next to your bed? For years, Steve has had an iHome clock radio to give him a clock by his bedside. It has a lovely 30-pin dock connector for his iPod, so that's super useful nowadays. And of course, a radio that we don't use that anymore either. The iHome was expensive at around $100, but it had one feature that had sold Steve on it. He could dim the clock every night and then undim it back up in the morning. Was it ideal for me? Because from my side of the bed, without my contacts, I couldn't actually read the numbers. Oh well, it worked for him. Recently, I was approached by Palo Alto Innovations to take a look at the Sandman clock. It's a clock that also acts as a USB charging station for four devices. That's all it does. No 30-pin dock connector, no radio, no Bluetooth, anything. It's a clock and a charging station. Now that doesn't sound too exciting, does it? Let me give you a spoiler. I was busy last week when it arrived, but without asking me, Steve replaced his iHome clock radio with the Sandman clock. He unplugged it and just put the Sandman clock in its place. He loves it. Okay, what's to love? Why this glee from Steve? The Sandman has giant LED numbers. I mean giant. Seriously, they're 1.8 inches tall. That's 4.5 centimeters to you metric folks. Even I can see the numbers that big from across the room. The best thing, though, is that they auto-dim when it gets dark. Being engineers, we spent several minutes covering up various parts of the device till we figured out the sensors on the bottom left of the front face of the clock. So for years, Steve's been dimming and undimming and dimming and undimming, and now the Sandman does it for him automatically. The Sandman is beautiful in its simplicity. The clock can be in 12 or 24-hour mode, and in 12-hour mode, there's a little red dot in the lower right telling you if it's PM. If the alarm is set, there's a red dot in the upper left. That's it for the screen. On the top, there's a snooze button and nothing else. The back is almost as simple. There's an on-off switch for the alarm and a plus and minus button. These buttons are to set the clock and the alarm. The Sandman folks made a conscious design decision to not increase complexity and cost of the design by adding in chips to find the time for you and to keep track of stupid things like daylight saving time. Also on the back are four USB ports, one of which is a high-powered one at 2.1 amps for tablets. You can have the cables go out the back, or you can have them come out the front by routing them under a channel that's built in there for just that purpose, or there's channels to the sides. The cable management is great, and the Sandman clock itself is less than half the size of the iHome, making our bedside table look so clean and organized now. Steve is super picky about how dim the numbers must be for him to be able to sleep, and he said the dimming was perfect. I read the manual, I know, right? And discovered that if it's not perfect for you, there's a combination of the simple buttons that do exist that allows you to change the amount that it dims. When you first open the Sandman clock, it's an odd experience. You're looking at the face of the clock, but there's this sticker over the whole thing explaining how to plug it into power. You would think that'd be pretty simple. It'd be plug it in. Nope. They've got a tricky little shroud that goes over the power cord that plugs into the back of the clock. And if you do it the way they say it to, it turns the little shroud turns into a stand to hold up the clock. It works great, and it makes the packaging super efficient, but it was kind of an odd first look at the clock. Not a bad thing, just surprised me. The Sandman clock is $45, comes in black or white, perfect for office, bedroom, or kitchen, and gives you a gray clock that's also a 4-port USB charger. Simple, perfect solution to both problems. Check out the images in the blog post to show you how much nicer and neater the bedside table looks with the Sandman now than it did with the iHome before. You can find the Sandman clock at paloalloinnovation.com, and if it looks good to you, you can buy it at the Amazon affiliate link in the show notes. If you feel you get value out of the podcast, or all of the podcasts, I should say, maybe you wish there was a way to help support the show and the work that we do here. One of the easiest ways to do that is to use Patreon. If you go to podfeet.com/Patreon, you can pledge a dollar amount a week, and you never have to think about it again. Kind of the insidious secret of it, right? Anyway, you could do $1,000 a week if you like, or maybe something slightly smaller would be more appropriate. We're not trying to make money here, but things add up, you know, in creating the show. The costs do add up, like that $29 for a new theme. If you can't spare the money right now, please do not stretch yourself to contribute. We will keep doing the show no matter what, I promise. When Steve and I planned our great adventure to South America, we knew we needed a data plan for our phones. We decided to use Project 5 from Google for $10 a gigabyte. I've written up the experience in a couple of blog posts and talked about it on the show. There's a link in the show notes if you somehow missed that. Project 5 gave us an inexpensive and fast internet access on our trip, but I had to buy an Android phone in order to initialize our Project 5 SIM cards. For most people, that would be kind of a drag, but for me, it gave me an excuse to play with my first Android phone. I bought a Google Nexus 7 tablet many years ago, but I haven't played with Android since then. The phone I chose to buy was the lowest cost model you could get and still use it to set up Google's Project Fi. I bought an unlocked European version LG Nexus 5X. I paid $300 for it on Amazon directly from LG. If you've been reading or listening for any length of time, you know I have an ever so slight Apple bias. For that reason, you should not take my review of this phone as a definitive and unbiased review. But I have a spoiler for you. I kind of like this phone. The Nexus 5X has 32 gigabytes of memory. It's carbon black with a matte finish, so the case doesn't show fingerprints at all. It's got a 5.2-inch screen with a resolution of 1080 by 1920. That puts the screen size pretty close to halfway between an iPhone 7 and a 7 Plus, just for comparison's sake. Its physical dimensions are right in between the two iPhones as well, with the thickness just about the same as the iPhones. Interestingly, the Nexus 5X weighs less than the smaller iPhone. Not a lot less, but it definitely weighs less. The back is plastic, which I'm sure contributes to its lightweight. But it doesn't feel at all cheap. You know how when something isn't dense enough, feels cheap? Doesn't feel that way. It feels good in the hand. The screen resolution is exactly the same as the iPhone 7 Plus, but it's on a smaller screen. But it doesn't look bad at all. It's bright and pleasing to the eye. Now, I don't want to keep comparing to the iPhone, since the lowest-end iPhone 7 at 32 gigs is more than twice as expensive as this phone, but I wanted iPhone users amongst us to, have a little feel of a comparison for how it looks and feels. Now, if you care about speeds and feeds, the Nexus 5X has a Qualcomm Snapdragon 1.8 gigahertz quad-core dual processor running inside it. From listening to other podcasts, I've heard that quad-core is important for speed with Android, but some of the efficiencies in iOS don't require that, and so that's why Apple hasn't done it. Or maybe they have by now, I forget. I don't know, I've stopped following those things lately. Probably the first thing to surprise me was how well the fingerprint sensor works on the Nexus 5X, especially since it's on the back of the phone. I know there's rumors out there about the next iPhone having a bezel-less screen and possible problems with making a fake home button fingerprint sensor built into the screen, so Apple might have to put it on the back. People are losing their ever-loving minds about that, but it doesn't worry me at all. I think if it does happen, we'll get to the use to the location in a short while, and we'll never look back. Most importantly, the fingerprint sensor was just as easy to set up on the Nexus 5X as it was on my iPhone, and it opens the phone just as reliably. Far harder for me to get used to is how to turn the Nexus 5X on. Sounds dumb, because the power button is on the right side, which is exactly where it is on the iPhone, and it turns the screen on instantly, but I just forget where it is for some reason. I'm sure if it was my daily driver, I'd get the hang of doing it, and the good news is that picking the phone up awakens the screen too, so I'm not baffled for long. I just have to remember to touch the fingerprint scanner. I guess I should point out that I pretty much do the same thing on my iPhone too. I'm always looking at it going, what are you waiting for? Why haven't you opened up? The camera on the back has a pretty big bulge, but since the iPhones have it now too, I'm contractually obligated not to mock the phone for that. If you've ever considered getting an Android phone, I'm sure you heard Bart in the back of your brain yelling, don't do it! But if you listen to that voice carefully, you also hear him saying, unless you buy it directly from Google so you can get the updates. But the Nexus 5X made by LG is a pure Google phone, so it gets all of the security updates as fast as they come out. I'm not restricted by any ISP telling me I can't have the latest hotness. In fact, while writing up this review, the Nexus 5X informed me I had an update to install. Just like with iOS, it always confuses me when I get a notification on screen that says to tap it, but it doesn't open. It'll say tap to open, and I tap, and it doesn't open because the phone is locked. Well, that makes sense. So I unlock the phone, and neither of the operating systems, Android or iOS, take me to the update. I really don't understand why they behave that way. If I just tapped it, and then I unlocked when you told me to, why didn't you take me to it? After unlocking the Android phone, I fiddled around looking for the update in the system settings, accidentally dragged down from the top once, and there was the update, yet again asking to be tapped. As soon as I did it, it asked me to download and then restart to install. The good news is I learned to pull down and find notifications. I know, that's where they are on iOS too, so I should have thought of that. I guess I just expected it to be different, so I didn't look there. One of the great things about Android is that once you give your life away to Google, setting up a new device is really easy. I gave it my Google logins, and instantly my contacts, calendar, and mail were all there. I can't speak for all Android devices, but the Nexus 5X gave me a ton of updates when I first logged into it. I guess it makes sense because the lag from when it's provisioned until it's opened by a user. Typing on the Nexus 5X is dreamy. They've got haptic feedback on it that I find really pleasing. I think if I left it on all the time, though, it would really start to bother those around me because it does make a fair bit of sound. Predictive text on this phone is very useful, and editing of the inevitable typos you make anyway is intuitive as well. I'm so new to the Android operating system that I can't possibly give it a run for its money. I did discover after installing my favorite messaging app, Telegram, that I could add Telegram contacts to my home screen. Can't do that on an iPhone. I added Steve Sheridan and Stephen Getz separately, only Steve's for some reason, anyway, on my home screen, and I was able to tap their names to begin or continue a conversation. Stephen Getz and I have chatted quite a bit this way, and he was none the wiser that I was using Android. The camera on the Nexus 5X is nothing to write home about. It is a 12-megapixel camera, but we all know that isn't really a good measure of quality these days. The optics and the processing on the phone have much more of a difference in the image quality you get. I wanted to do some photo tests on the Nexus 5X and compare them unfairly to the iPhone 7 Plus at way more than twice the cost. But that's where things started to go downhill in using the device. The Nexus 5X uses USB-C, which meant I was able to plug it directly into my new MacBook Pro without a dongle. Yay! Well, I immediately got a charging error from the Mac saying that USB accessories were disabled and I should unplug the accessory that was using too much power in order to enable them. The only thing I can figure is that the fast charging available in the Nexus phone was more than the Mac was programmed to provide. In spite of this error message, my other USB devices continued to work, and the Nexus 5X charged anyway, but the Mac was not happy. The next adventure was trying to figure out how to get photos off of the phone's camera. I opened image capture on the Mac on a dare, just in case, but the Android phone was not visible as a connected device. I went to the Googles and I found a Mac app called Android File Transfer App that allows you to navigate the file system of Android phones. I was pretty cool. I was pretty excited about getting to see the file system. I mean, don't you really wish you could do that on the iPhone? I know to this day, Steve complains still about not being able to see the file system. He really wishes he could get to it. When I launched Android File Transfer, I got an error telling me to unlock my phone. But my phone was unlocked. On some devices like the Zoom H2 recorder, I know you have to tell the device to act as a USB mass storage device. I figured that was the problem. I hunted around in the Android settings, but I found no way to control USB settings. I hunted around in the Googles again, and they said I had to enable the ability to transfer photos, just as I suspected, but several sites said you have to tap on the battery symbol on top of the screen to get to the right menu. Well, that made no sense, and I never could get it to work. Eventually, after clearing some other notifications, I discovered that if I pull down from the top, one of the options in the notification area talked about USB settings. From there, I was given five options. The first choice was charge this device. The second one was supply power to some other device. Now that's really, really cool because my iPad drains the Kangaroo PC of power when I try to use it as a display. So I wish iOS had this feature. Anyway, I digress. The third thing on the list was transfer files. The fourth was transfer photos, PTP. This option says to use it to transfer photos or files if MTP is not supported. Whatever the heck MTP is. I suppose I could have looked it up, but I didn't. Finally, I could choose to use this device as a MIDI interface, but I wasn't making music, so I did not choose that. Instead, the first option I chose was transfer files. And the Android File Transfer app finally let me see the file structure of the phone. That was really cool, and there was a photos folder. But guess what? There's no photos in that folder. I tried dragging an image into the photos folder, and it actually transferred my photo onto the phone. I opened up photos on the phone, and I was met with the Google Photos app begging me to share my photos in the cloud. I don't even think begging is the right word. It was pretty close to demanding. I defiantly chose not to do that. From there, it got confusing, like this wasn't already confusing enough. Because in photos, there's an album called Camera, and there's one called Pictures. All of the photos I'd taken with the camera were in the camera album, and the one I'd uploaded from my Mac was in Pictures. Well, that's kind of a weird distinction. Anyway, at this point, I realized I have successfully done the opposite of what I wanted to do. Still haven't figured out how to get the pictures off the phone and onto my Mac. Okay, back to that USB menu. This time I chose Transfer Photos, which I guess makes more sense. But when I chose that option, immediately Android File Transfer quit, and I couldn't restart it. Every time I tried, it just wouldn't do anything. All right, back to the Googles yet again. This time, I discovered that if you enable PTP, which is the Transfer Photos protocol, now Image Capture can see the images, and so can Apple Photos. It can see the phone. Well, that was a lot harder than it should have been. I can see why people agree to give their photos to Google's cloud service. I mean, who's going to go through all of this? Well, you might expect me at this point, now that I can successfully show you the photos that have come off the phone, you might expect me to do an exhaustive test of the camera on the Nexus 5X, different lighting conditions, testing all modes, changing subjects. But for this review, I'm only going to talk about one photo of Tesla. It's a demonstration of my observations of other subjects of other photos I've taken. The Nexus 5X camera is soft, lacks detail, has poor color saturation, and it will be a disappointment if you've ever had a good camera and a phone. It's important to keep in mind that the iPhone 7 Plus, again, costs much more than twice the price. Actually, it's probably pushing triple the price of the Nexus 5X, and it is the flagship phone of the Apple line, so comparing these images might not be fair. But the Nexus 5X camera's images still don't look very good. As much trouble as I had pulling photos from the Nexus 5X, I don't want you to think that the other settings are as hard. For example, I was able to easily figure out things like Wi-Fi and cellular network connections. I haven't by any means given this phone or Android an exhaustive run through yet, but I could see using the Nexus 5X for a week or so if my iPhone was in the shop and not hating the experience. I have one last comment. When we went to see Lindsay before we left on our big trip, I tried to show her my new Android phone. She promptly pushed it away from her and said, "Ew." Clearly, I raised her right. Well, that's going to wind us up for this week. Do not forget to send in your dumb questions, comments, and suggestions, or tell me if that weird bug comes back on the website, or you can say nice things about how awesome the new theme looks. You can do that by emailing me at allison@podfeet.com and follow me on Twitter @podfeet. Remember, everything good starts with podfeet.com. We got podfeed.com/Patreon to help the show. Podfeed.com/Facebook if you want to talk to other Facebook users. Podfeed.com/Google Plus if you want to talk to the plussers over there. Podfeed.com/Amazon if you want to buy things for the Amazon affiliate link. And if you want to join in the fun of the live show, normally you can head on over to podfeed.com/live on Sunday nights at 5 p.m. Pacific time, but not tomorrow, not this Sunday, not the 23rd of April. Do not go over there on Sunday night at 5 p.m. Pacific time, but you normally can. And when you do, you can join the friendly and enthusiastic Nocilla Castaways. Thanks for listening and stay subscribed.